You're listening to PX Pulse, a regular podcast bringing you fresh voices on critical issues facing HIV prevention research today. PX Pulse recently posted an episode exploring the questions under investigation in the ECHO trial, a large study looking at three contraceptive methods to determine if any of them increased a woman's risk of HIV. The trial results were published in June. None of the three methods stood out as riskier than the others. These are DMPAIM, also known as Depo-Provera, an implant using levonorgestrel known as Jidel, or the copper IUD. Still, the results are generating an important discussion, in no small part because the ECHO trial also showed that women in the trial population were facing what's considered high rates of HIV, a rate of about 4%. That means a rate of 4 out of every 100 women. In this special post of PX Pulse, two veteran African women's advocates talk about what these high rates mean for advocacy now. And we hear from the WHO's Dr. James Chiari on why the WHO guidance matters. But first, Helen Reese and Nellie Mugo, members of the leadership team of the ECHO trial, talked with AVACR Navita Jain to explain the trial results and their implications. Helen Reese began with the most fundamental finding from the ECHO trial.
When we started with this study, there were many people who said it couldn't be done, that we wouldn't be able to get sufficient numbers of women willing to be randomized. But we did that, and as you say, we enrolled nearly 8,000 women, and all of the markers of a high-quality study were achieved, and we set our bar very high. So the first thing is that we were able to do this study, and it's a good quality study. So that the results we found, showing that there, with the main analysis, that there is no substantial difference in HIV risk and acquisition between these three methods when they're compared one-on-one with each other in pairs. Those results are, I think, the most important thing. We've really scratched our heads about this question, particularly with DMPA intramuscular, for many, many, many years, with the kind of data we've had never being sufficiently the kind of quality we require to give a definitive answer. So the most important thing is that we've now been able to show that there is not a substantial difference in HIV risk between these pairwise groupings.
What would you say is the key message or the key takeaway that you would want people to understand?
I think there are two really important points here. For a woman seeking contraceptive method and she has her choices out, she needs to know now that not one of them is going to substantially increase her risk of HIV. This has been the concern over the years. However, even equally important is the fact that women coming to our reproductive health services have very high HIV incidence. So we need to take care of women, one, give them methods that are highly effective in managing their pregnancy desire goals. If they do not desire pregnancy, protection, and also support them to stay HIV free. So the integration of HIV and reproductive health services, if we walk out with nothing else from ECHO, and as we move forward, if we fail to do that, I think we'd have failed in many, many levels, and we'd have failed the women in the community.
So you're talking a bit about prompting action for programs, but what kind of actions do you think other stakeholder or key groups like ministries of health or funders, researchers should be doing?
We have an enormous unmet need for contraception. We're simply not reaching many of the women who need it. So I think the first action we have to take is to say, what do we have to do with contraceptive services? We've shown in the ECHO trial that it is possible to offer, with good training and support and counselling, high-quality contraceptive services that women appreciate, and many of the women in the study chose to stay on their methods at the end of the study. So we've shown it can be done, and yet we've still got this big gap. So in terms of health ministries, number one is let's have a look at these reproductive health services and say, how do we strengthen them? And then side by side with that is we've got to do something dramatically different and much more about HIV prevention. Clearly what we're doing at the moment, even in the context of this optimized package of care, which at the end of the ECHO study did include PrEP,
we still saw these really high rates of HIV infection. So we need to really say, what are we doing wrong? What should we do more of? And part of this is actually trying to enhance service delivery, do what we know works already, while we try to find better technologies. But for the moment, try and enhance reproductive health services, contraceptive services, integrate HIV prevention services, and roll out the things that we know, the PrEPs, the condoms, the female condom, roll those out, treat STIs. We're not doing that sufficiently well.
I also want to touch on something that I think is my personal view, but I think is equally important. In the ECHO trial, as service providers, we gave what we know. You know, though we gave PrEP towards the end, we need to firmen up access to PrEP in reproductive health services. But I think equally important is the recognition that the HIV epidemic, and we've said it often, is not just a medical issue. It's a social community issue. So we can give good services for the individual, give them information as an individual, but they step out to a community that must uphold their prevention. So how do we bring the community as partners in prevention of HIV? She needs a community that supports her and that's on board, that owns the problem, and that delivers solution.
So speaking of PrEP, I did want to ask a bit about women's PrEP use in the trial. Did it reduce risk? And how come so few women in the trial used it overall?
So the way that we introduced PrEP was when we undertook the trial in four countries. So we waited until the countries had policies to introduce PrEP, and that's when we introduced it in the study. That meant that we only introduced PrEP in any of the sites quite late on, Kenya being the first and South Africa the second. But it was quite late on in the study, so that really limited the number of women who started to use it. We had overall over 600 women who did choose to use PrEP. But it only amounted to 3% of the women years of the study. So in terms of impact on HIV incidence in the study, it wasn't going to ever have a very big impact. And I think importantly, in terms of our analysis, there were roughly equal numbers of women in each using each of the three contraceptives who used PrEP. Certainly in the sites where PrEP was supported, we found quite high uptake and continuation. So, you know, that would be a pointer in one direction. Other studies, there have been many studies now on introducing PrEP, and we know that it's not something for everybody. But we also know that if we get the message out there and if women are supported to use it, there will be a substantial minority of women and young women who will choose to use PrEP. And it really is something that we should be rolling out.
So we talked a little bit already about incidence being quite high in the trial in the three arms. And some people might look at that data and ask whether all of the methods increased HIV risk. Can you help our listeners understand why the trial doesn't support this conclusion?
So to really have answered that question, you would have had to have an arm where women were not using any contraception. And for two reasons, that wouldn't have been possible. One is it would have been unethical. Women seeking contraception and then saying you could be randomized to one where you don't get it would have been utterly unethical. So that wasn't going to be possible. The second thing is we think that women who want contraception are more interested in saying, can I compare, is there more of a risk with that one than that one than that one? They're interested in the contraceptive. They're interested in are there risks for that? Are there benefits? That's what they want to know. So that was the question we had to ask. So the second thing is that with the methods that we chose, two had progestins in them, but they were different progestins. And the other one was non-hormonal. And if you look, for example, at the DMPA-IM arm and you compare it to the copper IUD, the HIV incidence at the end of the study, the rate of new infection, was about the same. It was just about equal. And these are utterly, utterly different. One's hormonal and one's mechanical, if you like. Now, it's highly unlikely that all the two quite different methods would be increasing risk to the same extent, which is what you'd have to conclude. So I think that our conclusion is because we had two different hormones, both progestins and a non-hormonal, that, and we look at the background rates in these communities, that we think that it's unlikely that all of them were equally increasing risk to the same extent, highly unlikely.
The ECHO trial results answer some questions and raise others. For Jacqueline Wambui and Yvette Raphael, two veteran women's advocates from Africa, this trove of new information reinforces an urgent message. Interviewed together just outside the conference center in Durban, South Africa, after the results were announced, Yvette Raphael spoke first.
We see the high prevalence rates in this study specifically, but also the study mirrors what's happening in countries. We know that the new infection for women is still a problem. New incidence for women is a problem. So one of the key messages, it's around ensuring that there is better services and also prevention methods are made available for women currently, and also our dissemination of the results to women, for me, is top priority for us locally in South Africa, but I think my comrades also globally needs to be able to be on the ground, making sure women understand the results and start thinking about their own decision-making around their sexual and reproductive health. But also, many countries will wait for WHO to come out with guidance.
So to add on to that, of course, we are asking to be... Actually, we are demanding to be involved in that process. Looking forward to see what the guidelines are going to look like. The results show that there's a very big gap in terms of integration and what happens in the facility when a woman goes to access these services. And much as we are hearing words like the results are reassuring, for us that's a big no. It's absolutely not. The results are not good at all. The incidence was high, and seeing it came from countries in Africa where we have a lot of HIV prevalence, it means that we have a big problem with programming. And of course, the solution is just to involve the women. Ask the women what it is they want. What is it that a woman would like to see when she goes to the facility? Involve us in the planning, involve us in the programming. And of course, now things will be easier. So that would be the immediate thing, just to make sure that women are at the center.
Advocates like Raphael and Wambui want their voices in the discussion as the WHO considers how to classify the contraceptive methods in the study. These classifications shape policy in many countries, ultimately determining how providers will counsel women about these options. Dr. James Chiari is part of the team at WHO overseeing this process.
WHO guidelines are very important because many countries in the whole world depend on the WHO guidelines to decide on what care they provide and what products are made available to men and women and children all over the world. Specifically for these guidelines on contraception for women at high risk of HIV infection, we would like to ensure that contraceptive choices are safe and that we maximize the benefits, protection against unintended pregnancy, and any safety concerns.
And the point that I want to shine a light on is that there are many countries that rely on these WHO guidelines to decide what to do.
Yes, that is correct. And on this particular sensitive issue, there are many countries that will make decisions based on what WHO recommends. We are ready. We are making sure that the guidelines are available as soon as possible.
Gotcha. In what way will WHO incorporate input from African women advocates? At what points in the process would the WHO seek their input?
Also in the guideline development group, we'll ensure that there is representation from African women that will develop those guidelines. And the principle of all guidelines on reproductive health really is to ensure that we keep the interests of women and those affected by the guidelines at the center.
And from the point of view of an African woman in one of these countries where the findings are going to have a big effect, what's your hope for those women?
I think my hope for those women is that as researchers and policymakers and providers, program managers, we must continue prioritizing the safety of contraception and for the women to choose the method that they want and the freedom for them to prevent unintended pregnancy. So that is my hope.
Dr. Chiari, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jean.
At AVAC, we share that hope and a few others. The ECHO trial and its results should mark a turning point when discussions turn into action and the voices of women lead the agenda toward a day not far off when HIV prevention, treatment, and reproductive and sexual health are integrated and the choices on the shelf are affordable, effective, and many. Learn more about this work and so much more at avac.org. Thanks for listening. This is PX Pulse. You've been listening to PX Pulse, recorded in the Relic Room. Our theme music was composed by Alexi Stevens. Our engineer is Sam Baer.